Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline on this another beautiful Friday in June.
Ah, yes. Trying to be cloudy, but it's trying to be sunny, so let's hope the sun wins out.
Yeah, definitely. I saw we had some flash flood watch for this whole entire area, again, because of the heavy rains that we've had the last couple of nights.
Yeah, Packwood got 7 inches. Can you believe it?
Wow.
Yeah.
And they can't, the ground can't absorb it all, so it's running off into the rivers, and so we may have some repeat of some flooding in some areas. We certainly hope not.
Yeah, for sure.
For those people who've suffered through that already. Well, I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me today is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the program. We have an interesting program for you. If you're at all interested in writing, this is the program for you.
That's true. And, of course, you know, our theme is always writing, but we don't always have a writing coach.
Right. Exactly.
Us. And today we have Daphne Gray Grant, who grew up in a newspaper family.
Uh-huh.
Her family owned a weekly newspaper, and then she became a journalist herself. And from there, why don't you tell us the rest of the story? Welcome, Daphne.
Hi, Monica. Hi, Caroline.
Hi.
The first thing I have to say is that, you know, whenever I hear the words newspaper family, I think of Patty Hearst or something like that. And I have to say that, you know, it was a struggling little community weekly newspaper. So, you know, I don't come from a position of any sort of privilege at all. We worked hard and we struggled, but I guess the big advantage I had that at a very young age I was put in a position of having to produce, and that's the best way to learn to write is by doing it.
Mm-hmm.
So. There you go.
So yeah. How old were you when you got your first byline?
Oh, I was probably 17, I guess.
Wow. And do you remember what it was that you wrote?
I could not tell you. No. No. I do remember when I got my first, I sold my first national magazine piece. That was very exciting because it was much higher profile, of course, than a weekly newspaper, and it paid what in those days was serious money, and that was for a magazine called Homemakers here in Canada, where I am, and it was lots of fun to write. It was about learning to play a musical instrument as an adult, and I guess I was about 23 or 24 years old when I did that.
And what instrument were you learning to play?
The flute.
Oh.
Do you still play?
That's not easy.
Not very much. You know, I took up the flute because I really desperately wanted to learn to play the piano, but I was living in an apartment, and the flute seemed a more practical choice.
Yeah.
A little easier to get up the steps.
Exactly.
Of course, now people buy
Keyboards.
Portable keyboards,
and you can learn to play.
Yes. It's a lot easier now.
So were you ever able to learn to play the piano?
No, I took a few lessons with my kids, but I found, you know, trying to work, have a young family, and do piano lessons at the same time, it was just too many things. So, you know, when I'm retired, I'll go back to piano playing. I think
good.
I really did enjoy it, though.
Yeah, but you have to practice.
I know.
I teach piano, so I know you have to practice. And I tell people, if you're not going to practice, don't start, because there's no point in it.
That's right.
Yeah.
I envy people who can play a lot of different instruments. That seems really cool.
Well, the other thing I think, you know, is that writing is a practice, much
mm-hmm.
like
true.
An instrument is.
Yeah.
And you have to decide where you're going to put your focus. And for me, right now, at this part in my life, it's on writing, and that's the choice that I've made. So,
now, Daphne has written, let me tell people a little bit about what you do, and you can fill in and correct me as we go along. You
okay.
have a website called www.publicationcoach.com.
That's right.
You offer telephone classes.
Right.
On... for example, there was a teleclass recently, Double Your Writing Speed.
Yeah.
Another one, How to Be Your Own Best Editor.
That's right.
You offer a free newsletter.
That's right, yes. And I do want to emphasize that it goes out weekly and it's 100% free. And anybody who's interested in learning more about what I do, you know, should sign up for it because there's no obligation. It's very easy to unsubscribe if you decide it's not for you. But it's a great way to pick up some easy writing tips. And the other commitment I make is that I keep that newsletter very short. I guarantee that it doesn't take any longer than 3 minutes to read. So.
And I signed up for it.
Oh,
and
great.
I did. And along with it, you get a free e-booklet on mind mapping.
That's right.
And so Mom's been reading, Caroline's been reading that because that's one of her favorite writing techniques also.
Indeed. And it works. It really does.
And you also have an e-book available called 8.5 Steps to Writing Faster, Better.
That's right.
So growing up in a newspaper family, going right into journalism, did you always want to be a writer or did you ever consider doing anything else?
Well, I have to tell you, I hated writing for the longest time. Even when I was in the business, because I went from the weekly business, I kind of graduated from the weekly business to the daily newspaper business. And, you know, there I was working at this big city, big circulation newspaper in a room filled with journalists, and I just felt so incompetent and so blocked. I was terrified any time I had to write. I was hired as an editor, and I'm a very, very good editor. I think I'm naturally inclined to be an editor. I'm not naturally inclined to be a writer, but I struggled with that for so many years that I finally decided I just had to make an effort to learn some tricks and techniques that would make writing easier and more fun and less angst-filled for me. And so that's what I did, I assembled that information and put it together in a book because I thought that might help other people.
Now, as an editor at a daily, so you're not actually called upon to do that much writing? Is that?
No, it's not. The jobs end up being very, very specialized at daily newspapers. You know, there are people whose job it is who lay out pages and write headlines.
Oh, wow.
Don't write. Sometimes they don't edit. That's what they do. They lay out pages and write headlines. And if you're a writer, you don't usually edit. And if you're an editor, you seldom write. So the jobs are very, very distinct.
And then there are proofreaders.
Not these days.
Oh. I was going to say, they miss a lot. If they are, they miss a lot.
Daily newspapers.
Well, plus, I guess they figure computers will catch the spelling errors.
I assume so. Yeah. But, you know, I'd say the standards at daily newspapers have generally declined fairly seriously in the last 20 years. And grammar, spelling, you know, a lot of that stuff just isn't checked as rigorously as it used to be.
No, it's not.
So what made you decide to go from being a newspaper editor to being a writing coach?
Well, when I left the newspaper business when I had my children, and there's a teeny bit of a story in that I have triplets.
Oh, yes.
I didn't want to, while I knew I wanted to continue working in some fashion, having three babies at once was really not compatible with being in the newspaper business. So I wanted to be able to work from home. And so I started doing corporate writing on the side while looking after my three kids. And as they got older, my business grew and grew. And then I decided to set up an internet-based arm to my business as well. I find I like lots of variety in my work. And when I was in the newspaper business, one of the aspects of my job that I enjoyed the most was teaching. And once I was doing corporate writing and consulting, I didn't really have so much of an opportunity to teach, and so I thought maybe I could get a bit of that by setting up this web-based business and offering coaching that way. So that's how the publication coach was born.
And you still do corporate writing for clients?
Yes, I
as
do.
Well. So you're practicing what you preach.
That's right.
What you teach.
Well, I find it's very, very helpful to be engaged in what you're teaching about because you know, through constant practice, new issues come up and you encounter problems and difficulties and figure out ways around them. And it's just a way of keeping sharp. So I like to do a bit of both, yes.
Now, in step one of 8.5 steps to writing faster, better, it's make a plan, but you advise against outlining.
Oh, absolutely. There's a note on my website from someone who said that by abandoning outlining, that was one technique I taught him or persuaded him to follow, that he increased his writing speed by 5 times, I think.
Wow.
Outlining is a terrible crutch, and it causes so much difficulty in terms of interfering with the writing process. And the reason for that is pretty interesting. It's based on the science of how our brains work. And the reasons that you shouldn't outline are kind of the flip side of the reasons why you should mind map or cluster, which we just mentioned at the very beginning of this call. So what outlining does is it gets you into that linear, logical frame of mind. And what happens when you're in that linear, logical frame of mind is that it's very, very difficult for you to get new ideas. And writing is all about new ideas and about discovering. And I don't know about you, but I can cast my mind back even now to grade 9 or 10 and writing an outline and sitting at my desk and just not wanting to be there and feeling this huge sense of obligation and looking at these items on my outline and then having to write more words to kind of fill in the blank for the outlining, just feeling completely demoralized and exhausted by it. So outlining tends to be discouraging and tends to impede what I call the process of flow, which if you Google that on the internet, you'll see lots of stuff about writing and flow, and that's what you experience when you are sitting and writing and the words just seem to come effortlessly. You know, for most of us, that experience doesn't happen all too often, but when it does, it's really wonderful and really magical.
Mm-hmm.
And I find by abandoning outlining and switching to mind mapping or clustering instead, you can greatly increase the amount of time you spend in flow. And the difference between a mind map and an outline is that a mind map isn't as structured. So what you do to create a mind map is you take a piece of paper and you turn it sideways and you write your central idea in the middle of the page and you draw a circle around it.
Okay,
then
so first you have to have a central
idea. Then as ideas pop into
idea.
Your head, you just write them on the page and you draw circles around them and you join them by a line to the idea that inspired them. One quick point I'll make is that I sometimes see people who do mind maps and they're kind of outlining instead of mind mapping. They start to fuss about what lines belong where and what should be connected where,
mm-hmm.
And they try to sort of fill in all the blanks. I don't recommend approaching mind mapping that way. It should be very, very free form. I often call it brainstorming with yourself. So all the rules that apply to brainstorming, which is no criticism, no judgment, just let it come, all those things apply to mind mapping as well. I have an interesting story. I encountered someone got in touch with me who runs a copywriting business, and he had stumbled across my website, and he got my free ebook on mind mapping. And at that point, he had been offered a contract to do a book and didn't really feel he had the time to do it, but he kind of desperately wanted to do the book. So he read my little ebook on mind mapping and decided, well, yes, I think I can give this a go. And so he did a mind map for his book, and the word pancakes came to his mind. And so he wrote that down on the page, and he thought at the time, this is ridiculous. This is the stupidest thing I've ever heard.
Wait, what was the book about?
Following my advice, he just wrote it down, tried not to judge. Anyways, making pancakes ended up becoming the central metaphor for his book.
And what was the topic of the book?
He had no understanding of that, where came from, how it could be useful when he wrote it on the page.
Wow.
In fact, he thought it was stupid, but it worked for him, and he did finish the book on time and managed to juggle it with all his other projects, and he directly attributes that to mind mapping instead of outlining. So I think that's a little an interesting little story about how mind mapping can take you in different and unexpected directions.
Now, Caroline, as a former English teacher,
Yeah. You've
probably taught outlining, but you've also used mind mapping.
I didn't teach outlining.
You didn't teach outlining?
No, because I early on discovered what I call clustering, which is the same thing as mind mapping, and it worked so well for me that I thought, hey, you know, this is a great idea. And I never had too much luck with outlining, except when I was trying to take notes in a lecture course. But I think I could have used clustering in that too. Is that right, Daphne? You can use it for taking notes?
Yes, I haven't done that because by the time I learned about clustering or mind mapping, sadly, I was long gone from university.
Yeah.
But many people say that it's very useful for taking notes as well.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Daphne Gray Grant, who's the author of 8.5 Steps to Writing Faster, Better, and also Mind Mapping, and the website www.publicationcoach.com.
See, I was when I tried outlines to get some idea, then I think, well, this. Then I when I go to write the piece, I think, well, no, I don't want that there, and you know. But with clustering, all these ideas come, and they come fast, and you write them down, and then you can go back and look, and you can change things, and it's not carved in stone. An outline seems to be carved in stone for some reason.
Yes, I agree. It's an interesting psychological trick, and it is getting into that creative, free-flowing part of the brain. The metaphor I use in my book and what I like to tell people personally is that it's a little bit like driving a car. Only one person can have the wheel at once. And if your linear, logical part of the brain is behind the wheel, then your creative part of the brain is asleep in the back seat. And so it's really counterproductive to get into that whole outlining frame of mind.
What do you think?
Because that's not where you're going to make the interesting, unusual connections that you need to be able to write, just like my pancake guy did.
Is there any type of writing, though, that where you need to have the linear logical part in control and so it makes sense to do it from an outline? I'm thinking of maybe scientific, technical type of writing. Do you think?
Well, you know, I hesitate to speak about things I haven't done because I'm not a scientific or technical writer. But I think of someone like Lewis Thomas, who wrote Lives of a Cell, a really wonderfully written science book. You know, it's got the technical information there, but it's written for the layperson, and it's extremely engaging. And I can't imagine that in order to produce writing like that, that an outline would be a great idea. I also can't speak for fiction writing, because I don't know in terms of character management and scene management and those sorts of things. Perhaps some form of outlining may be useful and even necessary. I'm speaking from my own fairly limited perspective about basic nonfiction writing and feature writing. But I guess what I'd encourage people to do is to give it a try. The other thing I would say is that people do get very fearful, and I think you mentioned this, Caroline, about missing something or leaving something out.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the particularly great thing about a mind map or a cluster as opposed to an outline, is that you can have it all there. You just spill everything from your brain onto the page. I sometimes call it vomiting onto the page. And then you write, and you can go back afterwards and check to see if you've gotten everything in.
Yeah.
So that's something, or a task I tend to reserve for the editing process.
And you don't have to worry about whether...
Once I get that first draft out, then I will go back and look to see if there's anything missing, and I can go back and check my mind map and kind of cross lines through or put tick marks against all the points and make sure that they're in whatever I've written. And if they're not, then I figure out a way to shoehorn them in.
Or you can add
That's
something
part of the editing process.
Yeah, you can add something on that you realize will add to the piece, added on to that particular place. You don't have to worry about whether it's capital the capital A or capital B or one or two or whatever.
Exactly.
Now the thing is that when I was young and doing, you know, writing reports for school and doing outlines, I liked outlines. I liked doing them but I have a very logical, linear mind. I'm an accountant. And so for me, that was, you know, that came very naturally for me.
Yeah, but you also are creative.
Well, here's my question for you. I suggest outlining after the piece is written.
That's interesting.
Yeah, for people who are in love with outlining, that's what I suggest. Because what it does is that, first of all, it's much more useful place to be doing it, because then what you're doing is exposing for yourself the underlying architecture of what you've written. And it's a good way to check to make sure that it's logical and linear and that you've included everything you need to include. So the problem with outlines is that they're not inspirational. But they are very good at organizing things.
Right.
And so for people who really love that process, I say, fine, when you've finished writing, go do your outline so you can have a kind of an at-a-glance look at how your piece is constructed and make sure that it's logical and linear and makes sense.
Now, for someone who's trying to get a contract for a nonfiction book, book length, my understanding, I haven't ever done it myself, but my understanding is that having an outline is part of your proposal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what would happen if you sent the mind map instead?
Well, for a case like that, for a book, books are sort of special cases. And mind maps or clusters can work in a couple of ways. So what I did for my book, which is self-published, so I didn't have to worry about selling it to a publisher, but what I did for my own peace of mind was my first mind map was for the book as a whole. And that was where I organized the chapters. And that was not meant, that in a sense was really mind map as outline.
Okay.
You know, in many ways. But I certainly would never ever try to write from something like that. So once I had the chapters lined up, then I would do a mind map within each chapter, and I would use that as my jumping-off point for writing. So typically in a book proposal that you submit to a publisher, they will want an outline, which essentially is a table of contents or a list of chapter headings, and a sample chapter. So, you know, I think you can use mind mapping or outlining, but I think mind mapping is slightly more freeing, to develop that organized list of chapters. And then I would use a more free-form mind map or cluster myself to write one of the chapters. And then you'd submit the overall outline in one of the chapters to a publisher.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so out with outlining, in with mind mapping.
Right.
And you say this helps increase the speed of writing. Why is it better to write faster?
Well, it's very, very important to write fast. Again, going back to this concept of flow we talked about, because flow is, by definition, fast. And if you want to get into that flow state, you need to be writing quickly. I know this ends up sounding like a bit of a Zen cone or a, you know, tautology. You need to write faster because you need to write faster. the thing is, I think a lot of us have it in our heads that writing is a horrible, awful, slow process.
Yeah.
And I like to turn the whole thing a bit on its head and say, really, you should be dividing up your writing time and spending much, much more of it on preparation and much, much more of it on editing, and the writing part is only a very teeny tiny stage in the middle, and that should be the fastest stage.
Mm.
What I find people often slip into is that they start self-editing while they are writing, and that's just a recipe for disaster and slowness.
So if you're
but many of us, me included, write that way, and to this day, I still have to be very, very disciplined about not doing that. One of the tricks I recommend to people, which usually causes them to gasp, is that they turn off their monitor while they write. This this does hinge on being a good touch typist. But if you can do that, what that will do is it will stop the editor critical part of your brain from commenting and allow you just to stay in that creative, interested, innovative part of your brain, which is where the words will come quickly and easily.
That is a really interesting idea that I've never heard before. So
yeah.
turn off your computer monitor. Yeah, turn off the monitor
that
while you're
freaks
writing.
It people out, but
yeah.
It really works. and I still do that myself from time to time because, you know, even though I've been a writer for 30 years and even though, you know, I've sort of hammered out the system for myself that really dramatically changed my own writing speed, I still find myself slipping into that bad old habit of wanting to edit while I write. I used to have a laptop and with an extended keyboard, and so what I would do is just tip the screen down.
Right.
I have to turn it off, but I couldn't see it. Yeah. I've also had other people tell me that they hang dishcloths over their monitor so they can't see it. But there are lots of things you can do that will just keep you away from that and stop you from constantly editing because that is... That's the wrong part of your brain to be inside when you are trying to write.
So if you're writing fast and you're in the, so your writing speed increases, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the total time it takes you to do the piece is that much less because you're spending more time on the other steps. Is that true?
That can be true. Although what I find is that first of all, people feel much better about the process. So even if it's the same amount of time, it feels like less time. And secondly, once they get into the swing of it, the overall amount of time does tend to drop. There are many more efficiencies to be gained in the preparation stage and the editing stage. It's sort of this waiting for inspiration to strike problem that eats up a whole bunch of time.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can just eliminate that problem, then time does get saved.
Well, it's so much more fun to do it this way.
Oh, it's way more fun.
Yeah, and that, let's face it, everybody wants to do something that's fun.
Exactly.
Now, sometimes, you know, you get the advice, just write. People maybe use preparing to write as a way to procrastinate actually writing. So how do you draw the line between, you know, when have you, you know, what kind of preparations are really necessary and when is it procrastination?
Well, I have to say, I'm a bit of a contrarian that way. I know about the whole theory that people spend endless time preparing and put off writing. But I have to say that my experience has been people more often sit at the computer and try to write too soon.
Mm.
And that is a far, far bigger problem. People feel guilty. They see writing as at one step, and that's why I called my book 8.5 Steps, because they see writing as the stage where you are sitting at the computer with your hands on the keyboard. And writing is much, much more than that.
Mm-hmm.
And what I want people to do is to give themselves credit for doing the writing work even when they're not writing, quote unquote. So, you know, one thing I frequently do that I find extraordinarily helpful is I walk a lot. And I often think through the ideas for my newsletter, which is a fairly big commitment. I'm producing somewhere between 500 and 700 words a week just for my newsletter, and I want them to be good words and to make sense and to be useful for people. And so I often go for a walk. I get my idea and I go for a walk and I kind of let it percolate in the back of my brain, and then when I get home I might make a mind map and then I start writing. So it's kind of like, if I can use a household analogy, it's a bit like making bread. You know, if you time it from start to finish, it takes a very long time, but huge chunks of the time for making bread you're not actually standing in the kitchen doing it. It's
right.
Like the loaf is rising.
Right.
And it's much the same with writing. You know, you need that, you need to do your research, you need to think, you need that kind of percolating time, but you don't have to be sitting in front of your keyboard staring at the screen until beads of blood form on your forehead.
And if you try and bake that bread before it had time to rise, you're going to have a pretty flat piece.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you're listening to KRUULP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, and this is Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is the publication coach, Daphne Gray Grant. So in the preparation stage of writing, Daphne,
yeah.
what are the most important things that you need to do? Like, what's the single most important thing to do before you start writing?
I think you really have to think about your audience. Who are they? What is it that they need to know,
mm-hmm.
read? As writers, particularly in the corporate sphere, but I think in any nonfiction writing, we tend to get caught up in the message we want to convey. And that's a very kind of self-centered approach. And instead, what I like to do and what I like to coach people to do is to get in the mindset of the reader and really try to understand where they're coming from and what's going to engage them most. You know, I find in writing my weekly newsletter, the thing I often change first is my beginning, because I have the idea, I know what it is I want to say, you know, I have the concept for the piece, and I'll begin it a certain way, and 9 times out of 10, I'll go, nope, I can't do that, that's too self-centered. I have to get an approach or a way in that's going to be more interesting and more engaging. So one of the things I often ask myself is, what's the most interesting thing I can say about this? And to be able to answer that question intelligently, you have to know who your audience is, and you have to know what it is they want to know. So really putting yourself in the reader's shoes is probably the single most important thing you can do during the preparation stage.
Well, Daphne, you mentioned that what you usually, or what you often start with as your lead or your introduction to the piece, ends up being too self-centered or too, you know, not what's most interesting to the reader. And that reminds me of the piece that you had selected to read for us today.
Oh, okay.
So that would be a good lead into that.
All right, sure. What that piece is it's one of my newsletters. It's one that went out a couple of weeks ago. So my newsletter is called Power Writing, and this particular one was titled 5 Reasons Why You Must Murder Your Darlings. So here goes. I have a close friend whose work I have helped edit for more than 20 years. He likes to say that my job is to review his writing, find the very best parts, and then remove them. He is half joking, but only half. In my defense, I will say that I am simply following the advice of British journalist, critic, and novelist Sir Arthur Quiller Couch, who said, and I quote, "Whenever you feel an impulse to perpetrate a piece of exceptionally fine writing, obey it wholeheartedly, and then delete it before sending your manuscript to press. Murder your darlings," end quote. Quiller Couch formed his maxim while a professor of English at Cambridge University, and he used it in a series of lectures titled On the Art of Writing. Sadly for Quiller Couch, he seldom gets full credit for his sage advice. Kudos more often go to the better-remembered F. Scott Fitzgerald, William Faulkner, Mark Twain, and Stephen King. It's not surprising that other smart, successful writers would echo the professor's suggestion. After all, they know the inevitability of getting a little blood on their hands. Why? I'm so glad you asked. 1. Darling writing, and by that I mean writing that is clever, self-conscious, inappropriately literary, or writing that otherwise calls undue attention to itself, usually sounds forced and labored. You can almost hear the writer panting and gasping for breath. Instead, really good writing should look like figure skating or ballet, graceful, elegant, and effortless, even though it is the product of hard work. 2. Focusing on clever turns of phrase will slow down your writing. As I have said countless times before, fast writing is the best writing, even if this means the writing eventually needs repair. I know I risk sounding contradictory, but my philosophy, write in haste, edit in leisure, hinges on the concept of flow. This delightful state to which every writer should aspire is one in which words come easily and effortlessly. You cannot achieve flow if you attempt to edit or otherwise fuss while writing. Keep the two processes separate. 3. Clever writing usually adds length, and in this time-pressed age, no reader wants to be faced with more words than absolutely necessary. Consider the 19th century novel versus the modern one. My copy of George Eliot's Middlemarch is 880 pages. The novel I'm currently reading, Consumption by Kevin Patterson, is 400 pages. I'm not saying the latter is better because it's shorter. I'm simply saying that modern sensibilities demand more restraint. Middlemarch is still well worth reading, but the jury is out on your long sales letter or e-zine article. 4. Polishing your little jewels of prose will subvert your own editing process. When you're in love with what you've written, you're like the 16-year-old who can't spot the flaws in her own boyfriend. He's so smart. He's so good-looking. He's so perfect. No. 5. Writing is about making a point. Darling phrases, if we're honest, are usually about showing off a bit. Don't distract readers with your clever phrasing. Instead, persuade them with the merits of your argument. As James Carville might have said, it's about the content, stupid. Fiction writers are sometimes told, love the book, not the scene. For non-fiction writers, let me propose, love the finished piece, not the paragraph.
Thank you, Daphne.
You're welcome.
That was Murdering Your Darlings.
Yeah, the research I did on that piece was quite interesting because it was prompted by a subscriber who wrote to me with that phrase, which I had, of course, heard many times before, but didn't know who said it, and discovered all over the Internet that it was claimed by a wide number of writers, or attributed to a wide number of writers. But this now obscure British journalist and novelist was the guy who actually said it, so it was kind of fun to follow that trail.
Do you ever have something like that that you wrote and you know you have to cut, but you keep it somewhere else just in case you ever, in case there's ever a place where it's actually appropriate to use it?
You mean information that's too long or too much?
No.
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
Something that you've written that you love, but it's something you have to take out.
Oh, I see. Yes, I try. You know, actually, that's a very good point, because one of the things I recommend to people who are having difficulty cutting their own work is to create a kind of a slag heap of stuff that they can't use for a particular article. And then they can go back to it and kind of mine it for future use. So that's, you know, never throw anything out, even if it has to be removed from an article. You might be able to recycle it or recast it and use it in a different place.
And even if you don't, it's maybe a little easier on the psyche if it's...
Exactly. That's very true.
It's like your favorite clothes that you've outgrown.
Yeah.
Instead of getting rid of them right away, first they go into, you know, the upstairs closet, and then they go into the attic, and then eventually you can get rid of them.
That's a very good metaphor.
Well, you know, it's a well-known fact that clothes shrink in the closet.
Yes, I'd forgotten about that.
Yeah, especially, you know, from one season to the next.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. I don't know what it is, but...
Well, let's talk a little bit more about the research process.
Yes.
You've indicated that that while people sometimes get accused of doing too much research, you think it's often the other way around.
Yes, and where I find this is particularly the case is when it comes to interviewing people. Now, this task wouldn't be required of all nonfiction writers, but particularly for people who do work for corporate publications or for magazines or newsletters or articles, you often need to interview people. And the big mistake that I find many writers make is that they go into these interviews looking for facts. And facts are all well and good, and they're important, and you need them, but they're not the end of the story. And so what I like to suggest to writers is that if they are in a situation where they need to interview someone, in their mind's eye, they, before going into the interview, in their mind's eye, they take a piece of paper and they fold it in half. And on one half of the page, as they're conducting the interview, they put the notes about the factual information. And on the other side, they put the notes that talk about feelings, emotions, problems, stories, anecdotes, metaphors. And what people sometimes don't realize is that you have to actually ask for that stuff. There are very, very few people, except for those who are well accustomed to being interviewed, who will give you a great metaphor off the top of their heads. But you can actually ask for a metaphor, and most people will be capable of giving you one, believe it or not. In my line of work, I not infrequently end up interviewing machinists. And machinists are guys who are extraordinarily clever, but they do everything through their hands. They've got this brain-hand connection. They know how to repair stuff. They know how to fix things. They know how to come up with great workarounds for mechanical problems, but they don't know how to talk. It's very, very difficult to interview a machinist. And when you do, and frequently when you have to interview other types of people as well, you simply have to be very specific about the kinds of information you want from them. Otherwise, you get answers to the factual questions, and then you get a lot of, I don't know. And so one example that springs to mind for me was I was working with a writer who was doing a story on a device a machinist had invented for moving boards in a mill from one side of the room to the other. These are heavy oriented strand boards, and it was like a cart. And I read the writer's work, and I could not picture this device for the life of me. So I asked her to go back and interview the person again, and I said, you know, ask him what it's like. And what I wanted, I didn't use the word metaphor, because you wouldn't use the word metaphor with a machinist in most cases, but what's it like? And the writer came back to me and said, it's like a hospital bed, because it tilts. And as soon as she got that piece of information, I had an image in my mind's eye as to what this piece looked like, or what this piece of equipment looked like. And so you have to explicitly ask for things like that when you're in interviews. So say, what's it like? Explain it to me so that a six-year-old could understand it. Mm. When people start using jargon with you, as they are inclined to do in many, many industries, I find marketing people are among the worst for this. You know, they start talking about USPs and the value proposition, and I just want to scream. But you ask them to rephrase it in everyday language. You ask questions about how they felt about something instead of just about the something itself. You know, I end up doing a lot of stories on projects that are done, and you can collect the factual information. You know, how big it was, how much money it was spent, how many people worked on it, you know, what it's actually doing. But in addition to those questions, you want to ask things like, when did you know this project was going to succeed? How did you feel about how people worked on this? So you want to get in a lot of feeling and emotion questions whenever you can.
Because the reader wants a story.
Exactly.
Not just a bunch of facts.
That's
now,
right.
There's also a way of presenting the facts in a more interesting way. You have an article on your website that talks about presenting numbers in an article in a way that's more interesting. And I found that to be very helpful.
Yes. People often get buried in numbers in business writing. Really, again, I come back to this notion of having a metaphor. So, you know, you can say something is so many yards long, or you can put it in the context of a football field. That's just a very simple, straightforward example of how a metaphor can help people instantly understand a number. So don't rely on the number. Rely on a comparison to
something we're familiar with. Right. Well, when do you know when you've done enough research?
Well, what I like to say is, when you can talk comfortably about the topic, and if someone were to ask you questions or grill you on the subject, you could answer about 80 or 90% of the questions without having to, you know, go and look up some more information.
Yeah.
And when you're at that stage, you are ready to write. And, of course, there will still be gaps, and I go back again to this notion of trying to make the writing process as fast as possible. What I encourage people to do is, when they're writing, if they come across gaps in their knowledge, and this happens to me all the time, don't start doing research again while you're writing. Just continue writing and put blank spaces or X's and go back later and look stuff up. You don't want to break the concentration you've got when you're writing.
Now, is it best then to set aside larger segments of time to write in rather than trying to write for an hour here and an hour there?
Oh, my goodness. You know, I don't even think you need an hour to write. I encourage people to write in dribs and drabs whenever they get a chance. One of the things that happens is writing is often a bit like taxes. You know, you put it off and you put it off and you put it off and it starts taking on monstrous proportions in your mind's eye. And you don't want to do it and you keep procrastinating. I encourage people to write in 10 minutes if they have the time. Write at your desk while you're waiting for a phone call to be returned. Write when you're in the dentist's office waiting for your turn. You know, write whenever you can. Just scribble things down. I also like to use a digital tape, or it's not tape, it's a digital recorder that I carry in my purse, and it's very, very tiny, very, very lightweight, and I find it very good for taking notes when I'm walking. And I look a bit goofy while I do it, but that's okay. And, you know, so that's another way you can actually begin the writing process using the tiniest bits of time imaginable. And the big advantage of that is it's just like anything. They tell you if you do a little bit at a time, you break a big project down into small chunks, then it's not as onerous. And I find that truer of writing than just about anything else.
And you can get into the flow in 10, 15-minute segments?
Oh, yes, you can. Absolutely.
But then if you're...
What will happen is you may be annoyed when your phone rings or your appointment shows up.
Yeah, isn't it irritating to have
you
to stop?
You can actually get the flow in that time.
Well, do you think it's possible to maintain the flow for an extended period of time, or is that really not feasible?
I think that's harder, and it probably depends a bit more on how inherently interested you are in the topic you're writing about. Mm. You know, I find with the stuff I'm writing for me, if I'm really interested in it, I can get into that place where you kind of lose track of time and you're just going flat out. Sometimes if I'm writing for a client and it's not a project that I'm deeply in love with, it's work. And it's hard to sustain flow for something like that for any length of time. So it really does vary, in particularly with your own inherent level of interest in the topic, I would say.
The thing I like about clustering or mind mapping as opposed to outline is there's no wrong way to do it. And your mind map is going to be entirely unique from everybody else's, even if you're writing about the same subject. I'm thinking of students in school.
Hmm.
And, they can, wherever it takes them, and that's the great part about it.
Yes, exactly. You know, another image that might help is I often think of writing as like putting together a puzzle. And so if you think of one of those big, 1,000-piece puzzles, filled with lots of blue pieces representing sky that are exceedingly difficult to put together.
Yeah.
Writing is sometimes like that, and I find it can be very helpful. You know, you walk by your puzzle and you work on one or two pieces and you get them in and then you walk away and go do something else for a while. To me, writing's a bit like that. You know, I might have a problem with my beginning, and it takes some thinking and some puzzling time to figure out, how to get into the piece. And having a 10-minute go at it can be helpful because it's not long enough for you to get really frustrated.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I find about that is that often when you have a 10-minute go at something and then you write it down, and don't let yourself erase it until you go back to it later, I often find that stuff I thought was terrible is way better than I figured. And I may, when I come back to it fresh, I look at it and then I have another idea about how I might use it, just changing it ever so slightly. So working in little bits, little drips and drabs is very, very helpful.
Well, that's you don't hear that too often, you know, from...
No. You know, the one thing I would say about setting aside huge chunks of time, I think that's much more valuable for the editing process.
So let's talk about editing a bit.
You need to be able to have extended periods of concentration. And a good chunk of time, like an hour or two, can be very useful for editing. But less so for writing. You know, writing, I often like to say writing is a bit like a cactus. It thrives on neglect, you know. Not much water, lots of sun beating down in it, not very welcoming soil, but writing thrives on that.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is publication coach Daphne Gray Grant. Daphne, you said you're in Canada. I believe you're out in, is it the Vancouver area?
Yes, just north of Seattle.
Oh, great. I'm going to be in Vancouver in August.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you must give me a call.
I will do that.
I hope we have summer by then. We've had an extremely rainy year.
I saw that on the map this morning.
All the stereotypes about how it's never warm here.
So give us your website again so that people can write that down if they, you know, after they've heard this program, I'm sure they're going to want to.
It's www.publicationcoach.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there is a link on the top right-hand corner that will direct people to my newsletter. So you just click on the link, and all you have to do is enter your name and your email address, and then you'll be subscribed to my newsletter. It's free, and you'll also get a free copy of my ebook on mind mapping.
Now, Daphne, we have a few minutes left. I wanted to ask you about your book, 8.5 Steps to
Yes.
Writing Faster, Better. Why did you decide to publish that as an ebook rather than on more traditional publication form?
Well, I've done it both ways. It's available as an ebook and it's available as a hard copy as well.
Oh.
They're both sold exclusively through my website. I wanted an ebook to make it nice and simple for people. So for those who just want to be able to sign on to the internet and get something right away, you can have instant gratification. That was my original intent, and then I decided afterwards to make the print version available as well. So it costs slightly more to get the print version too, because I know myself. Having grown up in this industry, I love something that you can actually hold in your hands.
Right.
I'm just a book fanatic. I admit it. And so I thought, well, it would be nice to give people the option of having either. So there's the digital version or email version, which gives you instant gratification and is a little bit cheaper. And then there's the other version, which gives you both the electronic version and the print copy. Another advantage of the electronic version is that and I can tell you this because I did it myself, and it was a heck of a lot of work. The index is hot-linked. So you can actually go to the index and hover over the entry, and you'll be taken directly to that page.
Well, one thing I noticed about the ebook, you know, I'm a little bit reluctant to read very much on screen. I much prefer it on paper.
Mm-hmm.
But you have it laid out in a way that it's actually very easy to read it on the screen. So it's
well,
not
I take
just
no credit for that. I give that to my designer. He's a wonderful man. I've worked with him for 10 years, and I think he's just a genius. So I'll pass on your comments to him.
Yeah, because reading something that was actually laid out for a print version and just is a digital version is not that it's not that easy to do. And
no,
so yours
no.
seem
he,
to have
we,
been
we
really
worked very yeah. very hard actually, and went through a number of designs before settling on this one, which I think does work very well both for the electronic version and the print one. So we worked long and hard on that. But full credit goes to him for his creativity, I have to say.
And we were talking about mind mapping in longhand, of course, on a piece of paper, but you have also a technique for using your computer to do that.
Oh, well, there's lots of excellent mind mapping software out there, and you know, I think it really depends on the person. I have to confess, after having tried a number of mind mapping software options, I still tend to regularly go back to pencil and paper, mm-hmm. just because I like that sort of visceral connection between brain, hand, paper, yeah. For mind mapping. But I know a great many people who love the software that's out there, and most of it's very, very inexpensive, very user-friendly, easy to learn, and I give a complete list of options for both PCs and Macs in my free mind mapping book. So anyone who is interested in learning more and interested in some specific links to mind mapping software can get that in my free ebook.
Do you recommend actual writing longhand?
You know, some people like that. I have overused the computer for so many years that I find it physically painful to actually write longhand or anything other than short notes nowadays. So I can do a mind map, but that's about my limit. Otherwise, I have trained myself to write on the computer, and I don't find it it slows me down or impairs my creativity in any way. But some people do find that, so you have to know yourself. And some people do better writing longhand. And I've heard that in particular with fiction writers.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I guess it goes back to that old motto of Socrates, know thyself.
Yeah.
Well, Daphne, thank you so much for joining us on Writers' Voices. And
well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure talking to you both.
Thank you. And we will close today, as always, with a quote from Mom. But first, let me make this little announcement. Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, will be speaking at the Fairfield Public Library tomorrow, Saturday morning at 10 a.m., if you're listening to us here on Friday. She's an author and internationally acclaimed journalist and host of the daily grassroots global news show, Democracy Now!, and I believe that James Moore will have an interview with her coming up.
Oh, very good.
In the next program on Planet Erstwhile. And also, if you haven't made it out to the Sondheim Center to see Open Hearts, please do so. It's a wonderful, funny, funny show. It is adult content, so keep that in mind.
But they have some family ones coming up.
Yes,
so.
They do. Yes, they do.
They have Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat and also Banjo Boys, which is about Meredith Wilson.
Ah.
I interviewed Randy on my Burlington program.
Oh, great.
Wednesday, great. So, yeah.
Okay, and now for Mom's quote.
Well, I've always been a fan of Will Rogers, who is, of course, American humorist and down-home philosopher, and he says, the older we get, the fewer things seem worth waiting in line for. I'd have to agree.
Writers' Voices is hosted, produced, and engineered by Monica Hadley, Caroline Kilborn, and Shemaine Montana. Archives available at KRUUFM.com and WritersVoices.com. Writers' Voices is a production of KRUULP 100.1 FM, broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield, Iowa.